You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company. Learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and I'm here today with Chris Bianco, who is generally considered to be the poster boy of the artisan pizza movement. Chris and I met a while back, maybe 20, 25 years ago, and he was just kind of emerging as a guy who had redefined what pizza can be and what it can mean to people. And since then, has become the guy who's established the benchmark that other great pizzerias and pizza operators have aspired to. Chris is thoughtful. He's unfiltered. He's a guy who just thinks about pizza in a deeper way than most people do, and people love to hear him talk about it. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to hear Chris talk about what pizza means to him and what it can mean to all of us when it's expressed at the highest level. This morning, when I was thinking about getting together with you today, I just had this flashback on when we first met, actually, which was about 22, 23 years ago in 97 or 98.
I think 97.
And we baked bread together. We actually baked bread.
Yeah. I remember we made the pan and jian we met first.
That's right. Yeah. Which was in some ways very similar to your pizza dough, which was and one of my students, I was teaching in San Francisco at the time at the California Culinary Academy, and she knew you. She either had worked for you or and had eaten at Pizzeria Bianco. And I asked her, I said, I'm going to Phoenix for this conference and I need to bake bread for a presentation. Who can I call? What bakery should I call? And she said, well, there's really no really great bread bakeries in Phoenix at the time. But the best bread in Phoenix is at Pizzeria Bianco. You should call Chris Bianco. Mm-hmm. And you were still, you know, probably known locally, but not so much on my radar at that time. I hadn't heard of you. But I came out there, we made bread together, you showed me what you were doing, and little by little, I watched you kind of like, you know, start to peek out from beyond the Phoenix, umbrella to more and more people knew about you. And then next time I got together with you was a couple years later when I came by to sit down with you and talk pizza for American Pie. So again, first baking bread with you and having bread that good, you know, at a restaurant was already kind of a cool thing. And I think you were just making it from your pizza dough, right? It was just the pizza.
Yeah, that was just, I mean, like anything else, as you saw that setup. I think the one thing about even getting into this, you know, this business, like, which I never really saw as a business. I just thought as an expression of, you know, what do you have to offer? And I think, you know, growing up in New York, you know, having this little job at a pizzeria after school, you know, seeing it from a perspective of, you know, the owners trying the best they can to do with, you know, to take things as far as either what's expected or that they knew. But there were certain things that were always like, you never ordered anything but the pizza in a pizzeria. And, you know, bread and dessert was always an afterthought. And definitely if there was a salad on the menu, it was an afterthought or at least not as much thought. Yeah. And I think there was a lot of when I opened the pizzeria, there was a very conscious decision to say, you know, to think about, or in any situation, even this one, like doing Zoom, I was stressing a little bit the last couple of days just about hooking it up. As you know, it took me a few Mexicans to go on. So I would say, what's in our way? You know, what's in our way? Okay, having a stand for the phone, having the internet work, you know, what's in our way? And I think when we sat in a restaurant, I was never into blind tastings, and I'm still not. I think we've been blessed with senses and understanding where our food comes from. And I wanted to give people something from the beginning, even the way they were greeted, to how we made them feel, seems much more relevant today, to how they left the restaurant. And not just waited for this one sublime moment of like, let me just get to the pizza or just the best part of the song or the bridge or the whatever. you know, and I figured that if they were going to have, you know, sit down and, you know, get a heel of bread, you know, with a salad, you know, and make pizza something that it really wasn't so much growing up, man. We made a beeline for the pizza when I was a kid, and sometimes I still do that. And but I wanted to give it, you know, a totality of its place, just like everything. So I think there's always, maybe now, just having a lot of time to think, you know, a lot of metaphors in that experience as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that was so striking, number one, the fact that you were making your own bread at your pizzeria was way ahead of its time, because now more and more pizza operators are now making bread. And I think at the pizza expos and all the other places where we come together, that notion of encouraging people to make your own bread, you're making, already making the dough, you know.
Well, that was the thing. My partner, tomato partner, Rob DiNapoli, who I love dearly, you know, we have this conversation all the time about pizza sauce. Yeah. I'm fine to label something pizza sauce, but as we all know, pizza sauce is pasta sauce, is any other sauce. I mean, as we, whether we need higher hydration or we need to tighten it up or we need to hammer it through a food mill or we need just hand crush it or we like them whole. Well, bread's the same thing, and I think as you dissect it, if we did it honestly, you know, a lot of things are meant to, whether it's in government, whether it's in any, you know, we've been in a lot of goofy meetings, and a lot of those meetings in our life were so something at that meeting could be relevant or separate itself to some type of importance, and I think a lot of things have separated themselves in a confusing way, like grapes are ultimately wine and dough, like bread, you know, pizza was already bread. You know, if it's flat, you know, yeah. it's pizza or it's naan or it's whatever. I mean, but yeah. It's the same. And I think, again, in that metaphor of we're all, you know, all bread is created equal. What we do with it after that is up to us, how we manipulate it. And I think, well, isn't that poignant again? We're right about now. So yeah. I think all those things to me just made sense. And then, you know, the timing is everything. I had my brother, Marco, who, you know, my brother wasn't a baker. He was, you know, him and my dad had a tiny little art studio in New York. And, you know, like a lot of things that change over time, you know, in the late 80s, you know, like little art studios or design studios, people that did things by hand were replaced by Adobe Illustrator, by technologies, you know, when mm-hmm. people did it by hand. And that, you know, my dad lost his business in that way. And, you know, my dad was still able to paint and make a living. And my brother that did more than, you know, the lettering and things like that, was looking for a change. And I suckered him into come out to Phoenix. I knew he'd be a great baker, much better baker than me, because I was, and I used this analogy before, but like he was a kid that, if you gave him a model airplane, he'd spend all day on every aspect of the interior of the plane and the engine. And I wanted to just slap the wings on him, put the stickers on because I knew it couldn't fly.
Right.
And I think that totality, and that's why he's a better baker than I am, is in baking. I think there's a, even though we don't, you know, a loaf of bread doesn't fly, it's important to understand all the things that make it rise and bake properly and whatever. And I always have jokingly, but not really, always say you learn things while you burn things. That is true. You know, the knowledge is in our failures for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's important that, you know, we have some scribes around to make sure that we recognize those and calculate them. And my brother's now a very maniacal baker, where I'm still more like, if it's hot, too hot, maybe we'll bump it with ice water. We'll do whatever. We'll, you know, we'll figure it out. And, you know, that always freaks him out.
But I always think of Marco as the sort of the secret weapon, that sort of the unknown behind the scenes secret weapon of pizza.
No doubt. The best brother a boy could ever have, I'll tell you right now. My big brother.
It's great Marco. That you guys have such complementary, you know, skills that way too. And then you managed to keep that partnership. The band has not broken up, right? You guys are still working together.
Well, I think, That's funny you say that, because that's the one thing, if I have anything that I'm most proud of in my life, you know, obviously it's my family, you know, the way that, you know, my parents gave me that foundation about what's truly important, and everything starts here, you know, gaining the respect of the people that have known you the longest and know who you are. You know, it doesn't end there, but I think it begins there. Like, you know, to kind of, to leapfrog that and get some other type of acclaim when, you know, the respect of the people that mean most to you, is, altered at best. It doesn't seem like it makes sense. So I wanted that. I wanted that for my brother. I wanted that for my family. I wanted that for my peers. And now the people, like, you know, I look at the original pizzeria. I mean, you know, my manager, Dave, been with me, you know, 24 years, 25 this year. You know, our server, Lacho, you know, right now he's, you know, he's laid off, you know, but he'll be back as soon as we can open all the way. But been with me since the day one. His brother Alberto's is still with us since the first day. You know, and other people, 26 years, 22 years, 17 years. You know, those things are. It was always about parts. You know, not the sum. The sum is only, you know, like, you know, there's things every day that show me what the importance of the most minuscule, you know, piece of any puzzle. You know, God forbid a plane goes down and you find out a pigeon flying into, you know, I won't use the F word, but flying into the turbine took it down. You're like, God, could we invent a screen for that? Like this, you know, this massive thing with calculations and things, like we couldn't keep a pigeon, out of that from taking down and taking the last people. You know, so I think it's always like looking at anything, you know, like what will, you know, like look at our world now. You know, we build walls, we build bombs, we build everything, but it just took somebody, you know, sneezing on the wrong person and then being negligent to that in the world somehow, or not, you know, obviously, to put us in, you know, put the world at its knees and take the lives of, in this country, now over 100,000 people around the world. More people than most all wars combined, I believe. I'm not all the statistics on that, but
well, it's getting hitting. If not,
yeah,
already it's getting there, isn't it? Yeah. It's amazing how the world can turn on such a sneeze, like you said. But when you were talking about, you know, having the parts, the people that you've kind of have worked together, there's a synergy that does make the sum is greater than the parts. But you've got to have great parts in order to have this, you know, wonderful sum in the end.
Right. The sum is definitely greater than the parts, but they're not disconnected. They're not two separate entities. You know, well, it's like, you know, like all things, you know, like I am of my parts. I am of that thing, you know, no matter with the representation of that.
Yeah.
But to take the Jenga game of anything apart is only for it to fall, you know, so. I mean, I got that a long time ago, and now more so than ever. I mean, we've had some, you know, conversations I cherish deeply about, you know, our own spirituality and how we see our mortality, you know, and you know, I you know, we talked about, I had some challenges as a kid with asthma that were scary to me as growing up, and that kind of brushed with something greater than me.
Yeah,
you know, was only an incredible life lesson of gratitude and humility, and not a victim, but a lesson. Like if you're blessed to live through something or around something, what do we do with that? And it's affected the way I see, you know, everything.
Well, I tell you, I mean, I remember when we sat down at pizza. You had just opened the bar the next door to the pizzeria.
Yeah, right.
And we talked there, you know, before you had opened that evening, mm-hmm. and for a couple of hours, and probably our conversation that day became the heart and soul of my book, because there was a couple of things that to this day I still remember and I use them in all of my presentations. And the first one was I'd asked you what it is about you know, your pizzas that, and what you've learned from pizza, that what are some of the tips and tricks that you could pass on to other people? And you said, well, I think it would be a disservice to say that there are these tips and tricks that you can do that would make you a great pizza maker. He says, you said, I can teach people my tricks, but I can't teach them to care as much as I care. And you said, if I could find people who cared as much as me, we can make them a great pizza maker. But yes. And I've seen that everywhere that I've gone since. And as I went around the country, noticing that this is one of the differentiators of the places that separated themselves from the pack, was that there was always a person or people there who just cared more than any. And that's not something that's part of training. That's something that they have to bring with them. They have to have that sense of caring.
Well, I think you've seen firsthand, you know, around the world that I was just never comfortable with, you know. I mean, I respect people that have to be very, like back when I was a kid, I mean, there was labels off of cans and, you know, you hid your, what you use and everything was a secret. And, you know, a lot of those times, you know, in a competitive world, I understand the impetus of that, or the beginning of that, you know, almost fear, or either you're hiding something or whatever. I just found the transparency set me free personally. You know, I remember when, you know, Alice Waters or Daniel Blue or all these great chefs came to visit, you know, the first thing that I was, you know, I saw them notice is maybe look around the room or look at our shelves or like see this idiot's using this extra virgin olive oil and everything and it's specific, or, you know, what we, you know, dedicate ourselves to do through, you know, through organics, through anything that we could, that was what supporting local farmers meant. There wasn't a word. It was a commitment to your bottom line, essentially. So I wasn't an economics major, you know, I'm not an educated man, but I knew that there was a commitment to keep people, that they wouldn't stay with me now almost 38, you know, some of them 30 years, because I was nice. I had to make an economic commitment to them. I had to, like, I always said, like, if I don't have it, or if I got it, we all got it. And if I don't have it, you'll probably still get it, but not as much as either of us would like.
Yeah.
You know, so I think those principles of study, like I always talk about the totality of, you know, of anything. Like, you know, sometimes, you know, in our soundbite world, as we tweak and confirm or deny the next great or the worst, whatever, that we maybe miss the intention, you know, of that minimalism of whether it's a slice of pizza or a bowl of pasta, because you are going to get this, you know, ribeye with this salsa verde that on the next course that the table was going to share that you knew would punch them out. But they tweeted before, and now it's there's an unraveling of a lot of things. Anyway, that, you know, going back, I was just like, hey, if I could show you that I care, or not even that, if I knew that I care, and I welcomed you to, like, I would say, you know, love is a word to explain the inexplicable. One in that same way, and again, never more important than now. I could send you love letters every day. I could send you daisies. But if I make you feel sick and unwanted and negative, that is the only reality. It's indefensible, you know, for me not to listen to how I made you feel. And I know the way that I felt at certain times in my life when it was confusing with people that, you know, they went and you were invited on that trip and maybe you did get that crappy t-shirt that was their guilt back. Not that that ever happened to me or whatever, But there's things in I know in my life that when a customer, I don't even like that word, when a human being walked into our space that I was blessed to be part of a food chain, a part of a link of miracles to now stain their humanity to do something possibly great in the world. I know I've never been too busy to acknowledge another human being if I saw you in my peripheral. I've never been too busy not to nod. I've never been too busy to blink. I've never been too busy to do what I could to make, to hear you as a human being. And I think, again, understanding things that are pertinent in our world right now. You know, I didn't have the good stuff for when Peter Reinhardt came in. You know, everybody hopefully got the good stuff, the deserving stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? Exactly. That every, yeah. You know? You don't just pull out the special stuff for because this person is special, but everyone has to be special to you. And that was something that also out of that first conversation, one of the key takeaways for me was when you talked about, you know, the sense that you were doing this because you really wanted to have a relationship. You made the pieces right out there in front of everybody. You worked out there because the relationships for you were very important. It's what in a sense motivated you to keep doing it. It gave you purpose and meanings to have those relationships. And so when I asked you, well, what is it that you want people to experience when they eat your pizza? And this is the moment I'll never forget when you said, I want them to experience my soul. And the whole room went quiet. You said that, I was almost in tears and I didn't know what to say. And I waited for a few seconds before I could come up with anything. And finally I said, well, do they? And you kind of chuckled. You said, do they experience my soul? And I said, yeah. And you said, I think sometimes they do. And that was it. We couldn't talk after that. We had to stop. Yeah. And we just went and made pizza because where do you go from there? You know?
Yeah. I think, and even clarifying that, even adding my thought years later, you know, what I hope that, you know, people always see the totality of the village that it takes to bring anything. So my soul is actually a collective of souls, you know, and what I mean by that, you know, it isn't singular, you know, it isn't like, I would say I made nothing in my life. Like you make rain, well, maybe another conversation, but if you don't make rain, you got help in that process. So you've been part of a process. You know, that's the way I see myself is in that relationship business. If I had a job title with, you know, I'm in the relationship business. When any of those relationships are out of kilter, the imbalance is, you know, profound. And I think, you know, I've always, you know, jokingly had a, well, not even jokingly, you're like, I'm always uncomfortable when somebody says, oh, pizza master, or I'm a pizza master, or someone's like, you know, I don't see my role in pizza anything further from that perspective, because I see, you know, that, you know, kind of master and subject relationship, and not even beyond the obvious ones, you know, through history. But I mean, when we do not see ourselves with most entities that that we are in relationship with, like kind of going back to that pigeon and the plane theory. And then we know we've all had these, you know, you did everything right. You did everything right. And someday it just didn't rise. Or someday you didn't plan for everything. And there was 300 people outside. And you know, and the wood you got was green. Or, you know, the mastery, the wizardry does not always comply your dominance. Your what's the word of the day now? I heard on the news was, you know, your force or whatever that. You know, dominance. You know,
you have to dominate. Yes.
Yeah.
Stick around for more Pizza Quest after a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company specializing in creative digital video, photography, and podcast production. From concept through post-production, Hot Dish creates and produces compelling food stories that ignite the chef in all. Hot Dish Productions has deep connections to award-winning and celebrity chefs and over 20 years experience. Their team has won both a James Beard Award and an IACP Award for their work in food media. Hot Dish Productions delivers the highest quality product at a fair value. Let them help tell your culinary story today. Explore their work and learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
I'm a salt freak for a lot of reasons, but
it's, what is that salt? What's the story behind that salt?
About salt? I mean, well, there's a few different salt that I use. There's some that's from Marin. I've been getting some now from the Sea of Cortez. There's actually another salt that is very interesting. It's mined out in Glendale. So it's, you know, when you get a mined salt instead of a rake salt, you know, that's pretty fascinating. Water that was, you know, salt that was water 2 million years ago, you know?
And
that purity of it. And it'd be good for smart people to get involved in that and help us figure out, you know, the purities of that. And you know, as opposed to being raked, which I love from Trapani. I love, I'm a huge, the UK has been a great inspiration for me in my life. And, you know, I always have some Malden salt from Essex on hand. You know, so yeah, there's a lot of salt in not my wounds, but definitely in my heart, for sure.
That's always been kind of a trademark of your work, is that your connection to the ingredients, to, you know, to each ingredient, to every ingredient that you use. There's always something about what the choices that you made that were, again, ahead of their time. I mean, you were doing this in the back of the 90s when most people were just making pizza. You were thinking through everything. Now, a lot of people are emulating that and are trying to be, you know, that thoughtful about what they're doing, which I think is a great, you know, testament to the legacy that you've helped to bring about. And I know that you'll probably be the first to say you're not the only one that's with that message, but you are certainly one that a lot of people look to as an inspiration for that. And so we spent in the first segment, we talked a lot about sort of the philosophy and the buildup and everything else, but a lot's happened since the launch of Bianco and the launch of, you know, sort of your acclaim, and you've moved on. I mean, one thing you alluded to in our last conversation was that you had childhood asthma, and somehow that came back to bite you in the butt, right? Can you talk a little bit about, for those who don't know that story, when I interviewed you, you said you make pretty much every pizza and it'll always be the one making the pizzas there. You had one assistant who every once in a while would get to make one, but you said that was really important that you be the one to make those pizzas. And then all of a sudden you had to pass the baton. Yeah. What happened?
Well, there's about four parts of that situation, but I think, it's funny now, like you learn the, like even when you're making flour, you know, I wasn't wearing a mask. My head was in everything. You know, after years at that time, you know, I mean, I opened up in 88. I started working at a pizzeria when I was 13 after school. I definitely did inhale in that manner. And, you know, just my doctor gave me the best example of that, like, and to explain how it exacerbated my asthma. It you know, when I had to make a big change, which was if you get, you know, you put a wet hand in a sack of flour and pull it out, you know, that's ultimately what your bronchi will look like, you know.
Pretty good.
And mine, inside my lungs were just kind of overwhelmed by flour. And some people thought it was smoke, but the smoke really didn't have, you know, I wasn't inhaling, you know, and I had great extraction, you know. Smoke can be an issue in rooms that aren't properly ventilated, but that wasn't the case for me. And it wasn't about eating it. It was in the inhalation of it. So it was not to be confused in that way at all. So, you know, I got to a point where, and I'll even go back and saying that I wanted to make every pizza. What I said, you know, earlier segment about that, I always knew that I was part of a process. And what I wanted to do, the more little bit of whatever outside attention that I got, the more that I wanted to not let you down. You know, the more that I felt that, you know, that I owe, that I had a responsibility to understand that you mattered. Like, I had a few rules. I never put any type of accolade in my wall. I never put anything up on my, like, even on, you know, my Instagram, whatever. Like, it was about your discovery, about whatever I did. If I came and I sucked and I was rude and I was mean, that's your reality, which is the reality. But now faced with, okay, well, what's left? And, you know, I was talking earlier in my career also about, you know, understanding very clearly, the deal that we make and our parents make, we bring humanity into the world, is the skin and bone thing is a temporary game. So we better prepare for our release from it. And we better, you know, we can just, you know, close the shop, or we can build a template, you know. Some place will build a temp Well, I try to build a template, you know, to have a framework. Where, well, I say all the time, you know, Dan at Raza and, you know, obviously Tony Zimignani, all these great pizza guys over the years and some of the young guys, you know, Hans Palm in L.A. now doing cool things. Young guys, you know, women all over the world. I mean, doing things where they've, I would say if I raise the bar at all, it's so others could dance on it. You know, they could, they, you know, that work that to me was just, you know, was sensical. And even though Matt might have been the first one first to apply it to pizza, you know, I never invented a damn thing in my life. It wasn't inspired by, you know, whether it was nature or humanity, you know. So I saw in the 70s, you know, Alice Waters, you know, like looking at, you know, local aspects of food source, you know, obviously in Northern California was easier than at that time in Phoenix. Even though we had, you know, we have an insanely fantastic network of farmers now, you know, back when I moved out here, most of them were inaccessible. They were huge ag and not really, you know, everything was exported, you know, or yeah, at a minimum out of state. So I think, you know,
a lot has changed over this in that short period of time, that philosophical shift that took place between the 90s and the aughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the you know, I'll never forget, you know, every day I would, you know, I think about, I might have told you this already, but, you know, and it's not in a morbid way, but every day when I leave, you know, it started out just my kind of, my first sit down, you know, little pizzeria, you know, well, my second one actually moved once, but ever since 95, we've been down in that little red brick building. Yeah. And every time I pull out of the driveway, I try to look over my either left or right shoulder, doesn't matter, but I look at it like it's the last time I've seen it. And I want to make sure that anything I need to say to it or the people that are in it, that I attempt to either pull out and run out, or now since the cell phone call, or just make peace with it. And, yeah, you know, one day I'll be right, and one day we'll all be right in that way, you know? And, yeah, and I think if we looked at things and took it from, like when I was a kid, like no one wanted to talk about, you know, death, you know, no one wanted to talk about life, really. They want to talk about the party, but not really they cleaning up the party, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see, like in our business, it's a collective of New Year's Eve parties, but every day we're cleaning up the next day. We're rebuilding. There's always kind of, you know, we're, you know, it's kind of being born again daily. Like there's no really, there's an appreciation and a momentary celebration and gratitude for that day. But now it starts, you know, again, and we have to reprove ourselves and everybody coming through those doors. So just to kind of close on what happened in my transition of health was I just had to make a point to, and now at 58 years old, getting married late in life, I have three small children, you know, I realized that, and the one thing I'll say to any young chef that talks to him, I'll talk about, you know, do as I say, not as I did, or even whatever path you're on, it's not a path to emulate. You know, I've done some things and I was very blessed and very fortunate, but other things were really because I had no place else to go, you know. And, you know, like I needed that. And I still need to jump in front of the oven. I need to bake things. And I love it. I have a love for it. But there was a huge time in my life where, like, I was so, you know, overwhelmed, I would say. Like, you know, whatever type of attention I got. Like, you know, it was, I remember, I think it was 98 when Michelle Scipione wrote in her pizza book, and she picked this as her favorite United States. Everybody was like, well, you know, and again, grateful, humbled. I never believe in a singular best. You know, kind of a little bit like heaven. It's not an island. You know, we hope to get there with the other great, you know, people that practice the same thing. That's why I see my work. Yeah. It's not singular, but I'd like to be invited to that party of people that have brought good things to the table, you know, throughout history, you know. Yeah. And so in my transition of what do I do now, you know, is it's a little bit like, you know, you're a young baseball player, you throw 100 miles an hour, all of a sudden you're a crafty left-hander throwing 75, thinking about I'm going to either have to buy the team, be a third base coach, a pitching coach, a scout, retire on my pension. What's my role? And then the question I think is personal, how do I affect the game to its greatest and to its greatest good? Because that'll always be my greatest good. And I think me affecting my game or my greatest good was looking at first at what makes good things good, which is my life's work. What makes good anything good? Pizza is only as good as, you know, like putting pizza in the oven, like I could teach a robot. We're seeing now there's robots that can shape and bake. You know, you know, from rain down is where we make pizza, you know? That's where it makes pizza. You know, and the farmers as we prepare, you know, the soil. And as we talk, like, and when we plant tomatoes, when we talk about, you know, crop rotation. And it was hard red spring wheat last year, but that made it, you know, made the soil passive enough that it could, you know, the rooting systems could receive all the earth had to give it. So there was a lot of things like haunting me, which was I a problem of making America sick or the world sick by not worrying about nutrition when I was a younger chef? I knew about organic. I knew about good things on a surface level. But, you know, every day was a type of a revelation of, you know, where was, like, how and why did childhood asthma come into place? You know, or what, you know, we know a lot of things about it now, you know, a lot more things about it now. A lot of it just linked to, you know, in inner cities and our inability to be able to give children that don't have the economic means proper care or diagnosis. But there's other things, you know, childhood obesity and all types of issues that exasperate as we see the arc of when it affects children, usually about 4 or 5 years old, which when I got it when I was 5, when you first go to school, when you're exposed to certain things. Now again, very long story short, when I'm faced with what am I going to do, be a third base coach? Well, I already own the team, you know, which when I grew up, the pizza guy rarely owned the pizzeria, you know? Yeah. And I think as I've researched in my own research, and we go back to, and you probably know this history better than me, but even looking at like, you know, the original Lombardi's and all these, the pizzerias where I grew up, they're iconic. You know, a lot of times, you know, the pizza guy went to open their own place and the owner owned the pizzeria. Right. I think there's a famous picture of one had the flowers on their shoes and one didn't. And I forgot how that worked out. But
there was like a lineage. Of,
yeah. And we owe, yeah. And we all, you know, I pay homage to all those great people before us and all those great pizzerias, especially in New York where I grew up, you know. But I had to find my place, which was, I did make a template. There was my life's work. And now the continuum of that is, you know, is it the general manager of the, you know, the Lakers, or is it Jerry West? You know, now I think he's with the Clippers, whatever. But, you know, who shapes that? Who's the archetype for, you know, that? And so what I do, whether it's in my restaurant, Trotto, I've an amazing young chef. Cassie Shortino is fantastic. You know, what I try to do is illuminate what's already great about her. You know, I you know, sometimes, you know, restraint, staying out of a way, hopefully mentoring in a place that's specific for that individual. We all need different type of, temperatures, you know, when we bake bread, you know, or make a slice of toast. We need appropriation and we need language. Sometimes my language can be inappropriate for my kids. So I gotta temper that. But it was the most difficult chunk of my life, which was that transition from like when I went to work, you know, in the doors, the sign flipped at 5 o'clock before we went for lunch, you know, like I would pretty much black out almost to try to get to almost a, you know, like it was me and one of them, you were there. I mean, it was me and one guy, you know, he did salads and helped me shape. And, you know, we do, I don't know, 300 pizzas from 5 o'clock till 1 in the morning. you know, 320 pieces in a little oven. And for me to do that, you know, I had to kind of go to a place of you know, I'd look in the oven, and if I still look in the oven, the hypnotic nature and the peace that I find in that fire, mm-hmm. you know, and that very kind of, it's something that I still want to peek into, but I know I can't get lost in it anymore.
Well, you know, still, like, using that analogy that you were using, the athletic analogy, like, I think of, that made me think of someone like Larry Bird, who was phenomenal basketball player, but then, you know, age happens, and all of a sudden, he had to reinvent himself, and he became a great coach, and then he became a great general manager, and eventually will probably own a team. You now had to make that, you were forced to make that transition.
Right.
Maybe the schedule got moved up faster than you thought it would happen, but then you made it. So what are some of the, what are these next waves of the legacy that you're creating from this template? What are some of the projects, for instance, that you're working on? The one thing you mentioned already, mentoring the next generation. I think that we're seeing that a lot of the people that we've been talking to on Pizza Talk are people who have gotten to that point in their career where they feel that their next act in their life is to mentor the next generation. We call them the Council of Pizza Yodis, you know, and we try to get them on here as often as possible. And you're doing that, but you're also, you know, have a hand in a number of new product innovation ideas. What are some of those that you could share with the people who are watching?
Well, product wise, you know, like, I mean, over the years, I've had a lot of opportunity to slap my name on things, and I was never part of that, you know, not that there's any judgment, but I never want to put my name on something, but I want to put my heart in something. And if something grows from that, like, you know, I know you talked to my partner, my tomato partner, Rob, who's a brother.
Yeah, we've had Rob on.
And he's just one of the great humans on this planet who really cares that, you know, that, you know, generational family in California that comes from Italy and wants to, you know, that sees that the soil, the earth is good, you know, and now we can plant this fruit to feed people. And when he came to see me, you know, and very long story short is, you know, his tomatoes were great, but they weren't organic. They were, maybe the viscosity of the pack was a little bit thicker than I liked. Maybe they were a little firmer than I liked as well to process, which during the day, you know, and to appreciate that a lot of the, like, old timers, that would be important to make it look like a fresh tomato coming out, which is still important. And you know, whatever I wanted to be, I want us to study where could we, like, for our part of the world where we were from, just like the wine industry, like, having great respect for San Marzano, and I love those tomatoes, and, you know, I love Italy, but just like with wine, is Loire Valley or Willamette Valley, you know, Sac Valley, you know, for tomatoes or San Marzano, or where they were discovered in Chiapas, Mexico, or in Chile, you know, millenniums ago. So my role in any of this is, again, that study of what makes good things good, you know. Probably some of my biggest work and most rewarding work is on the tomato side, because it keeps me connected to so many young and older, you know, chefs around the country. Even I will say this about those tomatoes, where kind of like in our last segment, we talked about that, you know, pizza dough is bread dough. Well, you know, pizza tomatoes are, you know, Bloody Mary tomatoes or salsa tomatoes or, for your shishuka, whatever you want to make with tomatoes, like, you know, like, it's they're all invited to that party. So I think, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, in your opinion, then, what is it about a good tomato that makes it a good tomato? What was it that you were looking for to determine that it was good? In terms of your vision of what a good tomato should be?
Well, I think it started out with, you know, just like I would say, whether it's a rumor or a tomato, consider the source, you know, be handy again in our political systems right now. But digging into that source of, you know, back in the day, you know, people send you a price list and it's a sample. And, you know, and Rob could tell you that story better, but I'm not really interested in the price list. Eventually I will be. I mean, it's got to be economically viable, but it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
If it comes from a place of ill repute or a place of negligence to our earth or to the community. So I had to, even though, like I said, I respected Rob's tomatoes and they were great. What I was looking for more was as an end user, I've noticed over the years, you know, if I didn't kind of drain off some of the pack, the water pack, like in some of the tomatoes that I was using, to really get the yield that I needed, I wouldn't be able to get the viscosity of the pack. So there were, you know, somewhat in water juice. And when you, like, to make my tomatoes, it was real simple. I dump out a can, I put a glove on, and I just squish them up until I get to that place. And even all the pizzas we do today, we still do them all by hand. It didn't take that much, and we make it daily. It's not something I want. I want it to be bright enough, so from a flavor profile. So what I'm looking for a tomato is, first of all, I'm looking at one of our farmers, Scott Parks, told me a great story about tomatoes. And it's something that I tell all the time, and I might have said already, I apologize. But, you know, I asked him, he's been farming in Sacramento, Sac Valley, actually in Meridian, California, Yolo Town, border there, since, you know, the late 70s. And he said he was going to a student at UC Davis, and he graduated. He was working for a big ag company. And I asked him, well, what was that motivation to go organic, you know, especially in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, man, I just stopped getting stung by bees, and I stopped seeing worms. There was nothing else I needed to know. There was no other statistics.
Interesting. Very.
That I needed to understand. And I tell you, that to me, when I put my hand to squish a tomato, is something I think about all the time. Is whose hands there are in it might have some context. You know, when something is different and something has changed, we need to dive into that. You know,
well, I have an idea. We'd love to have you come back and with Rob and come on together and really dive in, spend a whole show just talking about the sort of the way you two guys kind of came up with what ended up becoming the Bianco Di Napoli tomato product.
Yeah.
So we'll set that up for another session.
Cool.
And but before we run out of time today, if just very briefly, talk about some of the other products. Because I along the way, I heard you were doing something with cheese. You were doing something with wheat. Are there other products that you're involved in?
On the cheese side, you know, it's more in support of people that are using, you know, good things. I got some calls from some cheesemakers we're trying to help, you know, as much as we can. Find out what we need. You know, it's like part of, like, for instance, like in Arizona, you know, we don't have really any dairy industry that isn't a part of, the union. It's not like a state like California, but there's a lot of independent dairies that are just making, you know, they're able to make like Double Eight in Sonoma, making amazing, you know, Double Eight Dairy in Sonoma County, they're doing amazing. I think Johnny Darsky's using them. Their cheese from Pizza del Popolo. Johnny's a great guy and a great pizzeria and a great man. But there's a lot of small cheesemakers making big commitments. And then you know, there's larger companies that are kicking tires on what we can do to save that industry. Most of my focus now on grains. Kevin Morse from Karen Spring Mills, a dear friend of mine. We use a lot of their grain. Hidden Flowers are made locally too. But the next part of grain, you know, Anson Mills, where I get Carolina Gold rice from. When I'm ever in Texas, you know, it's always, you know, James Brown at Barton Springs Mill, who's unbelievable, Miller, and connected to those great farmers. So what I do is, like I'm working with Kevin, let's just say now, right now, I'm on working with some other growers here in the Southwest and here up in Skagit Valley, where, you know, going to the, you know, if anyone's up to the, you know, the grain gathering, you know, the bread lab and, you know, talking to smart people and Stephen Jones, all these people that, you know, forgot more about. I mean, I can tell you kind of what I think is delicious or what works well, but I think it's important that smart people can tell us where things will grow well, what our yields will be, what are the you know, the economic impact to communities in that way, and environmental impact to our communities in that way. Like, you know, there's a very narrow, you know, in malting, for instance, there's a very narrow amount of grains that are malted, you know. That's not my expertise, but the way he's explaining to me was a lot of those parameters of the narrowness came from maybe those that made laws and invested in certain commodity grains. Yeah. So that could be affected to bottom lines. You know, smart people can help me out on that. But knowing what's best more than what's just, you know, we can grow a crap load of, and, you know, I don't know anybody who makes a lot of money doing great, you know, doing really, you know, great work. I know I'm still working hard to do things that matter, you know.
And that's, I think, really the bottom line of this is wanting to make a contribution to making the world a better place, leaving it better than we found it by where we are, where we're planted. You're doing it. You mentioned Anson Mills, and Glenn Roberts spoke at a conference that I put on in Scotland, Wales, and he's a brilliant guy. And he talks about this, I think, is going to get hopefully more and more of an impact, is the idea of polycrop farming, where you can grow numbers of things together, harvest them together, and make a kind of a unique blend of flour. And we've made some extraordinary breads using his polycrop flour. But, I mean, we could go on and on. And what we need to do is sort of get you back, because we're running out of time for this segment. But
you
I'd
know
love to get you back
brother.
For
you know where to find me.
Another one. You and Rob, and we'll just keep going. What's that? I'm sorry.
I'm
to
easy
hear
to
that.
Find. You know that. You know where to get me.
Right now, yes. There are times when it's hard to know whether you're in LA, whether you're here, whether you're there. Yeah. But next time we get you back, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other restaurant projects you're doing, and explore. I think I really would like to spend a whole session just exploring the idea of what makes good good, because
that's a party I want to be invited to. I'm ready.
That's my big takeaway from today, is that whole notion of what is it that makes good good. And
what makes good things good, man.
Well, Chris, for being,
well, I'm grateful to I'm grateful
for
this time.
A lot of people on that quest, on that search, for doing good and making good, really appreciate you spending as much time as you have with us today. So
well, thank you, Mike.
We're gonna get you back for sure, because this is a conversation that will never end.
Yeah. Well,
we can talk for hours.
Whatever I was fortunate enough to inspire others is only a reflection of the inspiration I received from a lot of different mediums, you know, in our world and in my life. And I try to pay them homage every day. And let's hope the next time we meet, the world's in a kinder place. And God bless you and your family and everybody watching.
Thank you. You as well. And
yeah.
Just give my best to Marco and to your whole family.
You too, brother. And tell your wife, I will definitely save her some salt. I got some salt for your wife, for sure.
I'll tell her. I'm going to tell her that you promised her some salt. She'll be thrilled.
We got it. Maybe some pepper,
so
too.
Until
we'll
the next time.
Maybe salt and pepper. Some chiltepine. I forgot for her. From Sonora.
If you send it, she's going to be in love with it.
All right.
Thank you.
Peace, brother.
Chris Bianco, thanks for being with us on Pizza Talk.
Thank you
all for being with us today. And join us again for the next segment of Pizza Talk. Chris, peace. See you soon.
Pizza Quest with Peter Reinhardt is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.